Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Courtney Dominguez.
So Raul Vega, welcome to the Ivy Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. So listen, give everybody a little bit of background on yourself and also Auxys Consulting.
Well, I'm the CEO of Auxys, and we're a management consulting outsourcing firm really focused on helping companies improve their operations on the back office. My career, I come from a finance background, originally with Pricewaterhouse and then PepsiCo, before going on a complete tangent, which has been the last 23 years. I founded Auxys and I've been doing that ever since, working with executives on a variety of growth and optimization initiatives.
So I think this is such a great topic for you because you've seen, not only from a consulting perspective, but also, you know, as a practitioner as well, you've seen so many different finance organizations. So what are some of your observations on how the role of the CFO and finance has changed over the years? I mean, I think it went from really a very traditional space to now evolving to something a bit different. So what are some of your thoughts on that?
It's interesting. You know, when I think about it, I got into this because in probably 1994, 95, in that time horizon, I got put on a project at PepsiCo, which was a project called Project MVP. And when I think about what the purpose of that project was, it's very similar to what it was today. And it was really all about looking at how our CFOs, our finance directors in the field, I was in the international division, could really add more value to the business and what was getting in the way. And that's really what led me to get put on this project, which completely changed the direction of my career. And it was all it was the very beginnings of business process reengineering. It was the very beginning of IT really getting big in corporate. I mean, that's when I first found out what an ERP was. They were just emerging. So when I use that as context, I think there's always been the same kind of goal happening, I think, for the last 20 or so years to really drive more value. What I think has changed, it's more now accelerating, and you don't really have the luxury of waiting more than you had then. I think the drivers back then, if you really think about it more in a bigger picture perspective, you know, it really ties a lot to what happened with the fall of Russia and the whole, you know, Iron Curtain in 1989, which opened up the international business we know today. And that was the big driver back then, especially for multinationals, but it really wasn't impacting mid-market firms. And if you really now take that forward, that monster that was unleashed has been going on for the last 30 years with international expansion, but also international competitors, non-traditional competitors. That just flowed right into the whole internet age, a technology age, which we keep driving. So what you really look at is we're in this very disruptive phase, really my whole professional career. And CFOs are really under a lot of pressure to drive a lot more value and have a seat at the table much more than they were before, where they were really more scorekeepers.
Yeah, I think it's a lot broader, and there's so much partnership now between not only just the finance organization, but CFOs really do partner very much with CIOs and across the entire organization and COOs as well. So I think kind of they used to stay in their lane, and now it's a lot broader from more of a strategic perspective.
For sure. And I think it really depends on the size of the company, mm-hmm. right? So what you really find is the large global Fortune 100 companies, the CFOs still kind of stick to their lane because of the complexity of the function, right? If finance is all encompassing at that level, whereas your mid-sized firm, they've always been more operational, but I think the capabilities and the needs have just grown exponentially, and some old models just don't play anymore.
So I think this is interesting, especially when you start talking about like finance transformation. There's a lot of digital, you know, a lot of buzzwords about finance and digital transformation. I was reading a statistic from Gartner that said, according to Gartner, 85% of finance teams are undergoing or plan to undergo finance transformation, but only 30% of them are actually considered to be successful and deliver some of the forecasted benefits. So, you know, I'm sure you and your team is seeing this as well. So what are some of those benefits that, you know, finance teams are looking for and some of the best practices to get there?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I think the biggest problem, you know, in general, the quote that you're saying there, finance transformation, kind of applies to broader IT projects in general, which is to me very aggravating because I've seen these mistakes going on 20 plus years and I still see the same mistakes being made, which you think we would have learned a little bit more about that. And I think people do know, but it's just so many more people are doing it that they still fall into the same traps. But the benefits are obvious. I think CFOs just are under, and it's not just CFOs, but we're talking about CFOs today, but really CEOs are looking at their CFOs to really bring a lot more commercial acumen and commercial value, right? And they, if you look at my perspective as a CEO, where do I want to invest? Do I want to invest in sales, marketing, my delivery operations, or do I want to invest in my back office? I don't want to invest in my back office.
Nobody does.
It goes to everybody. So then the question becomes, I need to do it. And when I, and it doesn't mean I don't think they're a valuable partner, but I want them to be more helping me drive the business, not just tell me what happened. And I think at the end of the day, that sort of discussion is what leads to finance transformation. And I think people throw the word out there, transformation, but they don't really know what they mean by it. And I think there's different levels of transformation, and then that will really drive what you're trying to get out of it. In some cases, it's a cost play, right? Hey, I wanna just be more efficient. I need to lower my cost of finance. But in my experience, that hasn't been really the big driver. It's always a component. You need to have a business case for it. But more often than not, it's how do I drive more value out of my finance function to the business, which typically means how do I get the business to be more of a partner, providing more insight, providing more analysis, not just on the financials, but operationally, even helping sales in those areas to really be better thinkers and cut the lead time for decision making. So when you start taking that component, then it says, okay, I need to free up time. And then that leads to a lot of automation on the transaction processing line, because I can't do these things if I don't have the time to do it. And I think that's the benefit that people are looking for at the end of the day. They don't want to waste time on these non-value added. And the reason I say non-value added is they obviously need to get done, but they don't bring commercial value to the business. And they want, I think most companies want to focus more of their time, effort, and energy on commercially valid and viable things that are going to make a difference versus back office. And that's the real benefit they're looking for. They get confused sometimes and think, hey, the benefit is I'm trying to find, say, 3 or 4 FTEs here, 3 or 4 FTEs there. But that's not really the bigger picture in my mind, typically, when you really dig in.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, I think cost used to be a big driver, but I think that so many companies are already running very lean at this point for, you know, various reasons. And so, you know, although taking resources or you know, costs out of the organization isn't necessarily the biggest driver like it used to be. I think that was very much, you know, the case previously. So you mentioned though mistakes. So talk about some of the mistakes that you see organizations do and repeated ones, right? Because you see them across various companies. So what are some of the mistakes and the biggest threats to success?
I mean, it's interesting. The biggest issue I see, whether it's finance transformation or whether it's digital or business process, or it's a much bigger enterprise transformation, it's the same mistakes. Typically, people are chasing too narrowly an initiative and they don't have the big picture and it's not aligned across the organization. And the bigger the level of change, the bigger that is an issue, right? So if I'm doing finance transformation, let's call it, and maybe that encompasses process change, technology change, organizational change, because it can be all three dimensions. The more I need to understand why I'm doing it, what is the business benefit, what does the end state look like, and make sure that the rest of the executives and sales and marketing and the C-suite really understand why we're doing it, because it's going to impact everybody.
Yeah.
And what happens is that roadmap typically isn't in place. When you're talking about IT initiatives, the biggest mistake I still see is similar, but you add the flavor of being a technology-driven initiative. They're in love with the technology. They're talking to software vendors. And then they're saying, oh, this is all this stuff this technology can do for us, and we can go on the cloud, and we can go to NetSuite, or we could do this. But they don't really know the business value and what they're trying to achieve. And they forget that. And I mean, I ask a question very often. Okay, what's the very basic question? What's the business value? What are we going to get? And you'd be shocked how many times I can't get an answer. Oh, the technology is going to do this and this and this. Great. But what's the value? Right. Where are we going to be afterwards? Where do we go from there? And, you know, once you get past those things, then the question becomes, how are we going to get user adoption, which I think is forgotten, right? Because the only way it's going to be an impact is the users actually have behavioral change and are using it and are properly trained. And I see that issue with the cloud big time. You know, when you actually move to the cloud, and I'm not talking about the infrastructure side, I'm talking about the business apps, even something like Office 365 and OneDrive and using Teams and things like that. It's not intuitive if you haven't trained people how to use it. And it could cause a lot of inefficiencies if you don't do it. So those are very common. How do you select the right software? How do you get the organizational momentum? How do you build it? How do you get user adoption? Those to me are core fundamental issues, regardless of the type of initiative.
Well, I think one of the keys you're touching on there is communication, and how are you communicating it out, and you know, and getting the organization on board with it. Because like, it doesn't matter what project it is, any project, you have to have communication, and you have to have, you know, whether it's finance or IT, like you said, if nobody uses it and nobody understands the value, then you know, why are you doing it in the first place? So it's not going to provide any value.
And they underestimate the complexity, right? Yeah. Everybody, you know, I call it, you drink the vendor Kool-Aid or whatever it is. And you, it's like, oh, this is going to be Nirvana. This is going to solve all my problems. This is a silver bullet. And it's not, right? It usually takes rolling up your sleeve, brass tacks. And people need to invest upfront in the organizational alignment and the strategy before they get into the solutioning phase, whether it's technology or none. And that to me is the skip. They say, we're ready to go. People are action oriented and they want to take action. And what happens is they skip that step and then they wind up having to go back to it repeatedly. And it makes it very inefficient versus if you did it up front, you lined it up, you were more realistic, then you can speed through it. And I think that's just, it's a human nature thing. People are incented to take action and move forward, not to do planning and alignment. It's kind of the boring stuff, but the critical stuff.
Yeah.
But it's hard work. And sometimes the project may not make sense when you do that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people have like they want to get it done. So I that's the thing that I see commonly still happening when I talk about what's happening. 25 years ago, it was different systems or different solutions. Now you have more cloud-based, but it's the same thing.
I always tell everybody, anytime there's IT or technology involved, that's the easy part. The technology is going to work. It's going to do what you want it to do. It's how do you implement it and how do you get people to use it is the hard part. Because the IT piece, it'll work every time. That's the easy piece.
You're right. If you've picked the right technology.
Right.
Right. Well, I agree with you. Because people sometimes, I've been in a situation where it was, you picked the wrong technology and you try to retrofit it and it's a nightmare, you know? But I agree with you 100%. Look, the people is the hardest part. Leading and getting people to change and accept it and embrace it and support it. It's one thing to say, yeah, I'm going to do it. It's another thing to become an advocate for it.
Absolutely. So actually, let's talk about technology. So, you know, how are you seeing CFOs leveraging technology to optimize their operations? And what are some of the biggest benefits? Because there's a lot of technology out there, right? And like you said, it's a matter of finding the right technology and using it the right way. So, what are you seeing in finance organizations and how CFOs are really, you know, identifying that right technology?
It's interesting. There's been a kind of an explosion, I would say, in let's call them point solutions, right? Whether it's reconciliation tools like Blackline and Audra and Trintech or portals. I mean, all sorts of different portals or automation and the AP process and workflow, which is actually, you know, some of that technology's really come a long way in terms of the intelligence built in it. It's been talked about and it's been around for years, but it never worked as effectively as now. So to me, there's almost an explosion of technology types, but even more so an explosion of vendors. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of smaller solutions and point solutions. And I think CFOs are embracing it. If you really look at the finance function, you know, what's the most common technology used? I think it's Excel, right? Excel's used for everything in a finance team. And what's funny, I think Excel was first released in the early mid 80s, 82, 85 range. It's pretty old legacy technology at this point. I know it's there've been new releases and all that, but it's still Excel. And what's interesting, that's hard to get out of finance. I mean, those users, it's brutal.
Yeah.
But I do see that changing, right? With things like RPA and some of these other technologies, BI, Power BI, I think is has made a lot of inroads, or Tableau, which I think is the future of finance. And it's really, I think that assortment of technologies, you know, I think RPA and analytics and things like that are really going to actually fundamentally change the finance function, and probably get rid of the addiction to Excel, because they're just so much more powerful and they kind of have a foundation where if you're really a strong Excel user, you can pick these things up quickly.
So
I think that's, it's just all these different point solutions. Now that's under the big assumption that the ERP's in place and standardized, which is not the case. And a lot of people think that's the case, but it's not the case because people still do a lot of M&A. And every time you buy a company, you're bringing in new technology. So most people, in our experience, the ones we work with, are not standardized, even on the Mac and the macro systems environment. And that usually is where the challenge becomes to the finance team, right? If I'm running on three different ERPs and I may not even have a consolidation system, because that actually does still happen today, where they're consolidating on Excel or whatever, then they may be looking at a Hyperion or something like that to consolidate. So it really depends where they're at in their business maturity, in terms of what they're going to prioritize. But assuming kind of like the basics are in place, right? You have a decent ERP platform or financial systems platform, then I think it's all about these different point solutions. And then the question becomes, this is where I think a lot of the struggles are. Which system should I pick? What type of system should I pick? What should come first? What should come second? I think there is a lot of confusion out there. And, you know, I think that's where we get a lot of, we are doing a lot of advisory work, is really helping companies figure that out. And it reminds me a lot of when we first started the company in 1997. Back then, it was all about ERPs. And it wasn't the standard that was, say, 10 years later. It was really, there was a plethora of ERP options that we, companies we don't hear about anymore. Companies like Bon, you know, that was one of the leaders, or even JD Edwards, which is now, I think, part of Oracle, right? PeopleSoft was a standalone company. So there was all these systems, Solomon, which is now part of Microsoft, and Great Plains. They were all independent. So it was very confusing at the time, and then it consolidated, right? So my guess is there will be some consolidation coming, but I think it's still quite a bit of ways out. But right now, I think there's a lot of confusion of where to start, how to start, and it, you really need to have a good system strategy and a systems plan, and things need to build on each other. And that's another big thing that people don't do, is they don't architect their platform. Right?
Right.
They look at a solution and they don't look at the bigger picture in terms of, okay, I get my ERP in place, then maybe I'm going to do some other point automation, or maybe I'm going to do analytics and reporting and put that over the layer. So I think planning and architecture is where a lot of companies are now, that they need to kind of spend the time there so they can build a multi-year program. Because the last thing you want to do, and I think this is happening, people are buying a bunch of point solutions.
Exactly.
And now they have a mess on their hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another pet peeve of mine, is the SaaS model, right? Talk about the biggest change of all, to me, is the move from on-premise to SaaS, which is great in terms of, oh, wow, I don't have to host it. I can do all that. But I think there's a lot of downsides to the SaaS model, in my opinion. You know, one, I mean, I'm for it. I use it, but I'm leery of some of it. And part of what I'm leery of is, and I've seen this with vendors, is they'll give you the go out of, you know, get out of jail free card at the beginning, discount the living heck out of it. And then 2 years from now, they jack you up. They start looking for very unreasonable demands on pricing and contract terms. We've seen that happening. And you're kind of already embedded to them. And it's a challenge for companies. And then you have multiple SaaS providers, and your data is in different systems, and it's not necessarily that accessible to you.
Right.
To get it into your data warehouse, to analyze it. So it's a little more complicated than people think. I think this whole SaaS at an enterprise level.
That scenario you were talking about, I won't name the company, but we had that exact scenario happen where, you know, we got it at a unlimited users, ridiculous price, you know, everybody fell in love with it. And then we came back to renegotiate the contract, you know, a year or so later, and they jacked the price up like unbelievably. To the point that we said, okay, you know, we're going to have to find another solution. And then of course, you know, the accounting team actually in this case was in love with it. And you couldn't get it out of their hands, but then it's okay. So if we put another solution in place, then you have to rebuild everything. And it's a real quandary when you start looking at it, and then you have to try to switch vendors. So it's almost like, you know, you get these vendors and you have a real problem. If you need to switch for whatever reason, it becomes a real, really difficult task.
It's a real issue, I believe. And I think that story hasn't been written yet. I don't have an answer for it, but
yeah.
Besides, yeah, you can negotiate contract terms, but
right.
You can only get so far, but you really almost need to renegotiate out into your, say you're doing a 3-year deal, maxing out the pricing and things like that. You have to
yeah.
really think through these things, because here's the dirty secret of SaaS companies. All right. They're making 70% plus gross margins.
Right.
Okay. Not many businesses make 70% gross margins. So when you think about that, that tells you you're paying a lot.
Yeah.
Right. But there's a convenience factor, which is true. I'm not arguing that. But they're also, these SaaS companies, under a lot of pressure to show those 70% margins. So what happens is, if you buy these early companies, they're trying to get customer count
right.
up. And they'll give it away to get customer to count up. But then they're under pressure to now drive up the margin, and that's where you start paying the price. And I think it's something that you have to be really cautious of. In addition, it's very hard to get one provider to do everything for you.
Yes.
So now you're dealing with a multiple provider scenario, and it gets complicated, and it's very complicated for your IT. And that support
yeah.
issue, besides the pricing issue, there's a support issue that I think is often not considered appropriately in terms of what is the long-term support going to be required for systems. And I don't think companies have caught up to, hey, I'm getting the benefit, let's say, out of my supply chain team, but I'm dumping the cost in my IT department.
Exactly.
And then they start looking at IT and they start saying, why are we spending so much? Well, we have this system in supply chain, we have this system in sales and marketing. And they haven't really, and this is, again, I think the role of the CFO, which I think is a huge role, is they need to lead the charge to rethink the corporate IT financial model and how we view investments and how we view support. And I think that leads to a lot of issues and lack of business alignment between IT and the business, where I think the CFOs and finance teams in general need to bring a lot more value add, and they're in the perfect position to do it with activity-based costing and how we view analysis. Because right now, the old model of dumping everything in an IT cost center
mm-hmm.
And then doing allocations out that are high level, it really doesn't work anymore.
It's also interesting when you talk about the SaaS model, right? Because a lot of these products are not, you know, it used to be, especially with an ERP, where you implemented it and then, you know, eventually you started depreciating that. But that doesn't happen anymore with some of these products where you're going out and it becomes a real program, right? So you don't have the depreciation like you used to have, especially when you're talking about a SaaS model, where you don't have that same type of IT asset that you'd get to put in production, and eventually, you know, maybe you'll replace it, but it's 10 years from now, it's not the same. And so many of the costs move, like you said, when you go through a finance transformation, you may be taking them out of finance, but there's that added cost that has to go into IT in order to be able to support whatever it is, what, you know, the whatever library of products that you have or catalog of products that you have. So, you know, you do have costs, although you may be taking them out of one space, it's certainly being allocated in a different space. And I think too many people don't realize that.
Well, I think there's issues that are even broader than that. I agree with you 100%. You know, the issue with that you were getting at, which I think is an interesting issue with cloud and SaaS, is the whole movement from EBITDA to OPEX,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And the problem that I've talked to several conferences and with clients and private equity clients, and they still have an EBITDA focus on valuations, and it's wrong.
Yes.
You know, it's
yeah.
wrong. If the right business decision is to go to the cloud, you can't say, well, the EBITDA is the reason because it's the same cash flow for that business. So the financial metrics are broken there. They're not modern enough to the new way of doing things. But that is a reality, and we have seen decisions changed because of it. And it's going to be interesting how that plays out because there definitely are, there's a conflict there. And the other thing that you got it out was what I find interesting. Let's say we're doing an RPA project and say it's finance, and okay, we're taking 10 positions out of finance and we have, let's call it $250,000 savings, whatever. You better put that RPA support cost in there, and you better put that RPA licensing cost in finance. Then you have a true picture of the cost to finance. And those are the, we're behind those things. And that's part of what I'm saying. CFOs need to move forward and get out of the transaction processing and get into these types of subjects. That's helping the business run better and make better decision making, and which is really driven by analytics
And what I found
and
too,
processes.
to your point, is that I found that finance and accounting tend to be at the tail end of it. So they're trying to figure it out after some of these things have already, whether it's the purchasing of the product or whether, you've signed the SaaS model or whatever, and now they're trying to figure out how to account for it. And a lot of those conversations happen, after the fact and aren't happening upfront. So, everybody's tending to scramble to try to figure it out. But you're absolutely right. You need to make sure that you're pulling in those support costs and the cost of the subscription and everything in order to be able to fully calculate what it is you're really, getting from some of these solutions.
Yeah. And the problem I see, that's what I'm getting at with the traditional finance model. They shouldn't be at the tail end. Now that's sometimes broader than their purview, let's say. It's a broader company culture issue. But that's why you have to transform your finance team, right? To be respected and invited to the table up front, not be the scorekeeper at the end. It was really more of an accounting-oriented mentality than a finance-oriented mentality. And, a true value-added business advisor is going to get the respect of the different departments, and they're going to want you there. They're going to want you there because you're bringing value in terms of analysis, and support. And it's not just the corporate cop who's telling you, don't do that, don't spend, don't do that. And that's the whole, that's really finance transformation in the modern world, right? It's transforming your seat at the table, that you're part of helping drive the business and make good decisions on the front end, not on the back end. And that's the big change. And most finance organizations aren't ready for that. And I would make an argument they've gotten worse because of Sarbanes-Oxley. Okay. One of the observations I've seen, and it's fine, I find very weird, is I find finance individuals less tech savvy today than I did 15 years ago, and or 20 years ago even. And the reason is, I think early on, if you look at the history of IT in the corporate world, it started in finance. Okay, those were, they were the first, so they reported into finance. So when the big wave came in the late 90s and the early 2000s, a lot of finance professionals, I'm one of them, moved into IT projects and had business process work and started doing all this work. And there was a ton of people with my same background that did that same type of work. Then Sarbanes-Oxley came around. And I don't know if this is the only reason, but it's the only thing I can put my finger on it. And I think finance professionals were not getting put on those projects anymore. And they weren't getting that experience. And what you find now is more industrial engineers who have that background, which lack the control background and some of the things the finance folks brought to the table. So I find when it comes to bigger IT knowledge in terms of systems and processes and the different steps of testing and how to, they just don't have that experience, like, say someone that was 15 years into their career would have in the past. It's they've gone backwards, I think, the finance function.
I think you and I have had a very similar background because I was also a finance person that ended up in IT around that same time. So, but it's true. You don't find anymore. You don't find a lot of professionals that have that background of, coming from a finance and accounting background and moving. Moving into more of an IT function, I think anymore, it's really very, very separate. So you just don't have a lot of those for individuals today.
And it's a challenge. I could tell you for us, because we focus a lot in finance and IT. I love to hire those folks that have kind of the blended skill set, and we find it very hard to find.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point, especially when you talk about hiring and, the types of people I think that make great consultants, right? Because you can have those conversations with whether it's a finance professional or an IT professional. So I think that's really important.
No, I agree with
So
you.
let's switch gears a little bit because Oxus has another arm that they really specialize in as well, which is the nearshore outsourcing. So talk to me a little bit about how outsourcing has been affected by, a lot of the events that have happened in 2020. I'm sure that's really changed things quite a bit. So how has outsourcing been impacted?
I think it's been impacted in a positive way from my vantage point. I think the demand has only gone up. I think a couple reasons why. I mean, one, I think in good times and growing times, which has really been the economy over the last 5 or 6 years, people are a little bit more reluctant sometimes with outsourcing because they don't want to disrupt the organization. Even though it was still growing, I think what happened, there was a lot of people who were sitting on the fence and saying, I really would like to do this, but I don't really know if I want to deal with it now. And I think that all got stripped away during the pandemic. And I think it caused people to have a fundamental rethink of their business models at a level that they probably have never done, but definitely since 2008, 2009 was the last time, which was a long time ago. So a lot changed. But I think what we saw, we've seen a lot of increased demand in outsourcing. Now, outsourcing is, there's different flavors of it. Our flavor of it, which is why we're in nearshore, is a very value-added optimization. Improve your processes, bring in systems. It's not a labor arbitrage-centric model, which was the Asia-based model that started in the late, 90s, really early 2000s. So that view of outsourcing, which is, hey, let's just go put jobs overseas, not really automate. I think that's taken a little bit of a hit. I think it's taken a hit. It was already taking a hit that clients expect more. And I think with the pandemic, I think the distance, the lack of infrastructure in countries like India and the Philippines has become a real issue. And so for us as a nearshore provider, I think that was another layer that people are now looking at and I think are appreciating more. You're not saving quite as much on a labor arbitrage perspective, but it's closer to home, less risky from some of those issues. And I think it's easier to optimize when you don't have those huge time zone differences and cultural differences. So what we've seen is a real big uptick in our outsourcing business. And I think the other thing when it comes to finance professionals, I first got into the outsourcing business, finance related, probably about 10, 11 years ago now, 10 years ago. We were doing a lot of consulting work for large Fortune 500, Fortune really 200 on shared services. And what we saw at the time was that middle market organizations really didn't have a good solution because all the solutions were geared towards large companies, global players based in Asia. And that's when we first went into Costa Rica and opened up our center. But what we saw is the middle market was slower to adopt. They were adopting, but people were still finance. CFOs were, hey, I'll outsource my IT group all day long. I think we should, but don't touch my team. There was a control that I needed the people nearby, that I needed, Susie down the hall or Bill over here. And that's completely changed with this work from home model as well. And that was one of the bigger, I think, things slowing adoption down. So we've seen middle market companies also realize, you know what? We can work from anywhere. Some of these outdated notions are gone. So it'll be very interesting how that plays out. I personally don't believe people will go back to the old model of, I don't think it'll be where we're at today, where everything's work from home, because I do think it'll be a balance. But I do think we're going to learn that, hey, people can be 2 days in the office, maybe 3 days at the most, and it's better for people's quality of life and the business can run more effectively. And I think that helps in an outsourced model. I think the other thing that's helped is the need, what we've just been talking about, all the technology and the transformation. People just can't find folks to do that. And they're kind of combining one of the things we've seen, the outsourcing with the optimization into one deal. At least that's what we're seeing, because I guess that's what we do. But typically, our deals now are we go in and we help take over the function and we help optimize the function. It's all combined into one. And those are commitments we make up front, and we're bringing in all the technologies. We take it over and then we optimize and we deploy technology. So typically, the program is, a 12 to 15 to 18 month optimization program. And it's all front loaded with these ideas and these solutions from the beginning, which is a big change from the past thinking.
And like you said, you know, being closer proximity to kind of the nearshore options that you have is a lot easier to travel to when you do need to travel there. So, you know, getting there right now is not quite as hard as maybe going over to India or someplace else where you've got all of those factors involved.
And yeah, absolutely. But just the Zoom collaboration, right?
Yeah.
Or Teams collaboration. I mean, time zone is important. I mean,
yeah.
You can't optimize without collaboration. I mean, those two things go together. And I think that's the real interesting change in the outsourcing world is what is going to be the long-term play. I think you're going to see Latin America increasing their market share. I'm not saying that the India-Philippine model is over. It's not. But I do think it'll be different. And I think people are realizing there's a lot of value. You can get much closer to home and some benefits that were not previously. I think people thought of it as labor arbitrage. They thought outsourcing is labor arbitrage, and it's not. It's not really what it's about anymore.
Yeah, it used to be just the lift and shift, and now you've got more of the optimization involved.
And the other thing that's changed when it comes to that is I think people used to think, I'm getting less, so I'm spending less. And we see it with our clients for a while now. They once they went to Costa Rica, they realized, oh, I'm not getting less.
Right.
I'm spending less, but I'm getting more. And I think that's just increasing now. I think people are more aware of it. That it's not necessarily about getting less. I think more is driven by there's expertise you need to do transformation and optimization work. And if I can have a partner who can take care of the processes, which helps fund the optimization, which is what we're seeing, right? So they're combined, the two, is that you do the outsourcing with the optimization and you use the benefits of outsourcing to immediately fund the optimization, that becomes a very powerful tool versus doing them separately.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. So last but not least, obviously, you know, Oxus's primary business is in consulting, and I'm sure that you went from being a road warrior to being much more close to home over, you know, the past year in 2020. So kind of what's your view? You know, obviously, you've talked a little bit already about how things probably won't go exactly back to normal. Mm-hmm. But what do you think as far as, you know, consulting goes? Do you think the same is true for, you know, because as a consultant myself, I know, you know, clients a lot of times prefer you to be right there. But, you know, do you really need to do that now anymore, you know, needing to be on site 5 days a week?
I don't think so. I think that was changing already, not for everybody. But I have seen at the beginning when we started the firm, we were on the client side 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was just that was the way it was. Clients wanted you there and we wanted to be there.
If not 7 days a week in some, you know, some cases.
Exactly. But there was no such thing as you were in the office. I mean, I remember when I was starting my career at Price Waterhouse, I don't think I went to the office maybe once or twice in the last 2 years I was there. I never went to the office.
Right.
And that was just the way it is. Now I noticed with some of my friends at bigger firms, I think they were traveling more for their own sake than the client's sake, to have that presence and to have that play and build those relationships. And I know from an Oxus perspective, we've always had less travel. It's been part of our model. We still were traveling quite a bit, but not like larger firms where I call it commuting, right? Mm-hmm. We never had the consultant who every Monday would fly out and every Thursday night come back, right? The commuting model. I think the commuting model is dead. I think there's going to still be travel, but I don't think it's good. I just don't see one. I don't think consultants want to do it. As we know, you know what I know. It's very tough if you want to have any kind of balance in your life to be a road warrior consultant your whole career. It's really, really difficult.
It's hard.
And you saw a lot of people bailing out of that once they got to around 30 years of age, men and women, you know? And I think that doesn't make any sense, right? Why do that? Because a lot of people love the work, but they don't like that hardship. So I think that'll end. I think Zoom and these collaborative technologies will replace it, but it's not just the consulting side. It's also the sales side. I mean, we have sold significant deals this year, but we've never met the client in person.
Yeah.
I mean, that's never happened.
Yeah.
Right. And I know, you know, my generation, we're kind of like, we're struggling with that. I mean, I took 2 business trips this year. And those ended in early March, right?
Yeah.
And maybe, 2 real business trips, I would say. I've never done that. I mean, it's been I don't know, 1980s, you know, 1989, 1990, since I only took two business trips. We like the business trips. I like, that's the lifestyle we've become accustomed to, right? Business dinners, business collaboration. I don't think that's dying. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to go back to where it was, but I think it will come back. But I think the commuting will end. I do think there'll be more of remote work from different environments. I think, like us, we have a pretty big center in Costa Rica. We're not going to expand that center. We think we can now, you know, do the 2-day-a-week model, 3 days. So I mean, it's like a double capacity in that center. And I think that will be the future. But I do think it'll be a little bit more balanced than people think. You know?
I don't know about you, but I'm hoping American Airlines is going to honor my my status for a little while, since I haven't been able to do very much with it this year. So they hope they'll do something. I know.
I mean, but it's like just a little thing. I'm dying to go, but I haven't been to my Costa Rica operation since January.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had that operation for 10 years. I mean, I want to go back there. I want to see my folks. I want to go take them out to dinner.
You need some gallo pinto for breakfast.
Exactly. There is the human connection that people want. You know, and I don't think that's going to just disappear. But I don't think it's the stupid travel that I think consultants were doing before, you know, which I think there's a lot of stupid travel in our industry. You know, I used to know people that would travel to Brazil for a 1-hour meeting and then fly back. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's crazy. Uh-huh. Well, I think there's some kind of new normal in our future ahead of us. So we'll both be curious to see kind of how that shapes up and what that looks like.
And I can't wait to get there.
Right, exactly. Neither can everybody else. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it. This has been such a great conversation. And you and I have known each other for a while, but I don't think we've sat down and had a conversation like this. So thank you for being on the Ivy Podcast.
Thanks, Courtney. I really appreciate it. It was great.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please take a moment to rate, subscribe, and leave a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.